we as people. You know who we are? We're messy and we're sloppy and we make lots of mistakes and we trip over lots of stuff. And yet, we're people that God is changing to be people like Himself. Hallelujah.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
I remember contemplating the word humility. And way back when, I remember thinking, why would anybody ever want to be humble? Humble is like somebody who gets stomped on. Humble is somebody who's crushable. Humble is somebody who's kind of wimpy and weak. I didn't get it at all. Over the years, what I've learned is humility is something that I really, really want. I really covet. In fact, it's come to mean something that's very strong, because a person who is able to stand underneath, a person who doesn't, through pride, flaunt themselves to the top, is a person of true strength. It's a paradox, isn't it?
Yes.
Today we're going to talk about Barnabas in the book of Acts, in our continuing series, and just looking at different themes. And I believe you're going to tell us, Jack, that Barnabas was a real model of humility.
Yes, among other things. But one of the things that was most striking to me is his humility. As we look at him, we see other attributes, other character traits that are very remarkable. He was an incredible man, I think. In many ways, he's a kind of an invisible behind-the-scenes character that we all owe a great debt to, but he doesn't really get a lot of recognition. And that's part of the humility, is that he didn't need that in order to play the role that he did. He was quite tent to play a supporting role and not a lead role, and that's what he did, and he did it exceptionally well.
And maybe that's where you see most of his humility?
Right, yeah, I think so.
Though he was playing a very strong, very powerful, very central role, he didn't have to put out the trumpet and tell everybody.
Right, right. He first shows up in, there's a scene in the book of Acts where after the day of Pentecost, you have all these believers, or all these people who are believers or are intrigued by what is going on. I mean, this truly must have been a remarkable event, the day of Pentecost and the things that happened on that day. And you have pilgrims from all over the Roman Empire. I mean, maybe we should set the scene a little bit. The Day of Pentecost was just a festival within Judaism. And there are a number of festivals that Jews would travel the lengths of the empire to go to Jerusalem to celebrate in them. And, of course, travel was very, very difficult. So as the rabbis interpreted it, you could obey the law if you were from, say, Spain, you know, what is modern-day Spain, if you just attended the festival once in your lifetime, then you had fulfilled Torah, fulfilled the law, because it was such a hardship to get there. But it was a requirement. I mean, because the law said the law was written envisioning everybody living in Palestine, and once a year there were certain festivals that you were to go to Jerusalem itself and celebrate the festival in Jerusalem, and it specifically specified Jerusalem being the place that you did it. Well, the rabbis recognized you can't go every year to Jerusalem if you live in Spain, but you got to make it once in your lifetime. So the festivals were really huge, big deal in Jerusalem. I read a book once that said during a religious festival, the population of Jerusalem would, and I can't remember exactly the factor, but it double or maybe even more than double during one of these festivals, because there'd be Jews from all over the Roman Empire who would converge on Jerusalem in order to participate in the festival that year.
So Pentecost. For some people, this would be a life-threatening voyage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was dangerous to travel. It was expensive to travel. It was a major commitment.
It took a long time. Uh-huh, it wasn't months. Like they got on a 747 and showed up.
Exactly. So you have these pilgrims from all over the Roman Empire congregated in Jerusalem for Pentecost, and this really unusual thing happens. The noise like the wind, the flames of fire, the speaking in other tongues and praising God, and all of a sudden you have this whole community of people whose eyes have been opened, and they become bold and they become confident in proclaiming the inauguration of a whole new age with the coming of Jesus, who is the King, appointed King, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, that God has sent to begin the process of working toward putting together that final kingdom one day. Well, incredible message. And people were so intrigued by it that apparently what happened is instead of beginning their journey back home, they hung around. They hung around Jerusalem. So you have these pilgrims who, they don't really have a home in Jerusalem. Their home is elsewhere, but they've been staying there temporarily to celebrate the festival, but they've extended their stay. And their funds are going to eventually run out, and they didn't plan on this. And they don't really have the means to stay, but they're too intrigued to leave. Well, as those funds run out, there's this man, his actual name is Joseph, but they call him, they've nicknamed him Barnabas, which, according to Acts, means in Aramaic, son of encouragement. And one of these days I need to look this up to find out exactly in what sense of encouragement is that. What sort of son of encouragement is he? But Barnabas means son of encouragement in Aramaic. This man must be a man of some means. He has some real estate. He sells the real estate, and he takes the money, and he uses that, and he gives it to the apostles to be used by the apostles to help feed and take care of these people that have stayed behind that are undoubtedly running short of funds because they're travelers. You know, they're dependent upon the hospitality of the people in Jerusalem now. So he sells this real estate, liquidates it, and literally gives the money to the apostles so that they have funds that they can use to show hospitality to these stragglers.
Quite generous.
Very generous. So you see his gratitude, his generosity, the abundance of his generosity. He shows up again, well, and let's contrast him with the next story in Acts is Ananias and Sapphira. Ananias and Sapphira do exactly the same thing, as do many people. Many people then, following Barnabas' example, they liquidate some of their holdings in whatever form they are, and they give their money to the apostles. There's this couple named Ananias and Sapphira who do the same thing. The problem with Ananias and Sapphira is that they sell some property and give it to the apostles, creating the pretense that they have given all of the proceeds from the sale of their property to the apostles, when in fact they only gave part of it and they were holding back some of it.
So they were lying, they were being deceptive.
Yeah, there was a pretense there. And they, as you know the story, they got struck dead by the Holy Spirit for that hypocrisy, for that pretense. And I think Peter even makes a comment there. I mean, you were fully within your rights to only give a part of it. I mean, there wouldn't have been anything wrong with that. There wouldn't have been anything evil about that. But to pretend to be more generous than in fact you have been is a serious, serious evil. We could even talk about that if you want. But what's striking is the contrast between them and Barnabas. Barnabas it seems apparent from the text, was doing it to be generous, was doing it to be helpful. He wasn't doing it to look impressive. He was doing it simply as an act of goodness and of love and of generosity. Ananias and Sapphira were doing it to look generous without actually being generous. So you see the genuineness and the authenticity of Barnabas by way of contrast, I think. You don't hear anything from him again until Saul, who eventually becomes Paul, when he goes to the Gentile world, where this man Saul, who's been persecuting Christians and pursuing them, killing them, putting them in prison, is confronted by Jesus and actually ultimately converted to Christianity on his way to Damascus. He was a notorious Christian basher, I mean, Christian hater, Christian pursuer.
The ultimate bad guy for the Christians.
Exactly, the ultimate bad guy. And the Jewish believers were scared to death of him. I mean, they were understandably were terrified because he imprisoned them everywhere he went.
He was like a serial killer of our day, in a sense.
Uh-huh.
The kind of guy you never want to run into in a dark alley.
Right. Probably like Himmler in Germany to the Jews. I mean, that kind of notoriety. Paul, after a lot of kind of false starts, finally makes his way to Jerusalem, and the believers just run from him. They won't have anything to do with him, except for one man, and that's Barnabas. And Barnabas talks to Paul and, in a sense, kind of takes him under his wing and takes him and introduces him into the community of believers, gradually wins over the trust of the believers for Paul, supporting him, vouching for him, being his advocate with respect to the church there. So the reason I say we owe such a debt to Barnabas is that if Barnabas had not seen the authenticity and the genuineness of Paul's conversion and seen the significance of it and taken steps to pave the way for Paul's acceptance into the believing community, history might have gone very, very differently than it did. And who knows if we would even have the Paul of the New Testament, who wrote half the New Testament, doing those things, if we'd have his writings.
So what is it that Barnabas saw that other people didn't see, or how is it that Barnabas saw more? What's your explanation for that?
Well, I don't know other than I think that there are just some people who are very good at discerning and reading the character of other people. And on a number of different occasions, well, at least on two notable occasions, you see Barnabas playing that role. The other time you see that is...
Well, first, I just think it's quite extraordinary. Here you have a Himmler, mm-hmm. a Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And for somebody to be able to see beyond murder is quite extraordinary. So yeah. I'm just thinking that Barnabas, he was just an extraordinary man with extraordinary gifts of sight.
Yeah, I think so. And he was able to just, by talking to Paul, by reading the evidence, see the nature of his heart, that there was an authentic faith, an authentic repentance, a real wisdom, a real understanding, and Barnabas wanted the church to have the advantage of that.
You know what I'm hearing with Barnabas in both situations, both in his generosity and his ability to see Paul for who he was, is that I want to assign this label of humility to him, because he wasn't a man who was protecting himself against whatever bad would come. He was a man who, for whatever reason, had come to the place where it was okay to give up riches. It was okay to even risk his life to see what might be true in Paul. He had given up his life, in a sense. He wasn't holding it most dear, and I think that's the mark of a humble person.
Right.
They cannot hold it most dear in order to see other people, in order to care for other people. You have to get over yourself.
Right. And along those lines, then, what was really most striking to me is the other thing that Paul must have communicated to Barnabas, and I and I don't remember off the top of my head all the evidence that exists for this or what the evidence is, but as I was studying it, I certainly formed the impression that Paul must have conveyed to Barnabas what Jesus had said to him. And what Jesus had said to him basically is, Paul, I'm going to make you great. I'm going to appoint you to go to the Gentiles and proclaim the gospel to the Gentiles. There's several pieces of evidence that suggest that Paul has communicated that to Barnabas. Now, if we put ourselves in Barnabas' shoes, we are a leader in the church in Jerusalem. We are a substantive person. We ourselves are discerning. We have wisdom. We have understanding. We have a lot to offer people. And Barnabas clearly did. He clearly was a leader type. You see that in Acts 2. People followed his lead in selling their possessions and generously giving that to the pilgrims. He's clearly a leader. He could have been, knowing the human heart, knowing my own heart, knowing what makes me tick, it would have been very easy for him to want to grasp the limelight, hang on to the limelight, whatever limelight he had, whatever role he had, whatever leadership he had, whatever status and power he had in that community. He could easily see Paul as a threat, because here Jesus has made a promise that, Paul, you're going to be a big deal.
And it really looks possible because, say, for example, if Hitler was the one that God had called, my heavens, if it really worked out that Hitler did change and become a man like Paul, what an influence he would have, so much bigger than someone who had never been seen for his evil.
Right, right.
The contrast of evil to the good would be just enormous.
Right. So what most of us would have done in Barnabas' shoes, I think, would have been to be threatened by Paul and do whatever we could to
subdue him.
Yeah, to undermine and subvert his success and try to advance our own success, our own leadership, our own power, our own status, or something like that. But you find Barnabas doing exactly the opposite. He believes the witness of Jesus and decides, okay, if that's what God is going to do, if God is going to take this man and make him an apostle to the Gentiles, then I'm going to do everything I can to help make that happen. He's obviously putting God's agenda above his own. He's saying, whatever it is that God wants to do in the world, that's what I want, and I want that so much that even if that means I take the back seat, I play a supporting role and not a lead role, if that's God's will, then that's what it'll be. I will gladly take the back seat.
Okay, so I want to tell you what I'm thinking. So people could be saying, oh, right, that's what I do. Here's the formula. I just kind of decide to put people ahead of myself, and then that's going to make me humble, or that's going to make me good in God's eyes. And I don't think we're saying that.
No.
It's easy to contrive it that way because we want life to be kind of that easy. But what we're talking about is a man who, from the heart, has changed such that he really believes in God. He really wants God. He's really transformed and gripped with a passion by wanting to love God. And it isn't a formula, it isn't behavior, it isn't just the thing he's doing. He's acting out of who he is.
Right. I mean, actually, there's two issues. That's a very important one, that he's genuinely acting out of who he is. He's not just kind of slapping this behavior on the surface or on the outside. He's not following a rule or a formula. This is authentic. This is coming from inside. But, as you point out, you can be utterly humble and take the lead role as well. Moses is a great example. Moses is called the meekest person who ever lived or something like that somewhere. And yet you can't have a much more prominent role than Moses had. So you don't have to take the back seat to be humble and to be meek. It just so happens that's the case with Barnabas, because that's the role that God wanted him to have, and God wanted someone else to have the lead role.
But I think, in a sense, Jack, you're always taking, even a leader like Moses took the back role in the sense that he didn't demand or usurp authority.
Right. Right.
He didn't take it out of hardness and
ambition,
selfish ambition and stomping on people. He was the leader because he had the heart of a leader. He had the heart of a servant. He was a person who was committed to what was good, and people followed him out of that.
Right.
And so, yeah, he was up front, but up front in a very unique way, a very
right.
humble way.
Yeah, exactly. But that comes to your point, is that what we're really finally submitting to is the will of God. I want what God wants. And if God is requiring of me that I be thrust into a leadership role, then I will accept it. Why? Because I wanted it? No, not primarily because I wanted it, but because God is requiring it of me. God has asked that of me. And so I will do what is my duty, my responsibility, my calling. I do it as a servant of God, not as one who's seeking status and power and position from my own heart. And that's the difference. But if I'm doing it because I'm seeking God's will to be accomplished, then it really won't matter to me what my particular role is. If it matters to me that I have the lead role, then we have to ask ourselves the question, where is that coming from? Isn't there some ambition at work here? But if I'm content to play whatever role God has given me, then that's the kind of humility that everybody, every child of God should have, and that we see exemplified in Barnabas. And it becomes all the more striking that that's what exactly his attitude is, because he's quite content to play second fiddle to Paul. But it's truly a supportive role, because the next time we see Barnabas in Acts, Paul has been a miserable failure at every turn. I mean, every time he opens his mouth, somebody wants to kill him. And he has to run from one city to the next to escape some plot, some conspiracy to murder him or to assassinate him. Finally, he gets driven all the way back to his home at Tarsus. And he's there. It doesn't specify how long, but it looks like years. Just hanging out in Tarsus. Maybe he was teaching. We don't know. I mean, there's no indication, no record of him really doing anything there, with respect to the gospel or ministry or whatever. Maybe he was just studying. Who knows? But in Antioch, another town in Syria, which was just across the mountains from Tarsus, a group of believers begin to start taking the gospel to Gentiles. And that, apart from the remarkable event of Peter preaching to Cornelius, that's the first time that you have the gospel being proclaimed on any kind of ongoing basis to Gentiles. And so in Antioch, you begin to develop a community of believers that are a mixture of Jews and Gentiles. Word gets back to Jerusalem that that's happening. And they go, wow, that's pretty amazing. Let's go check this out. And one of the people they send to Antioch to kind of investigate and on a fact-finding tour is Barnabas. So Barnabas is sent up to Antioch. Barnabas is very encouraged by what he sees. He supports what they're doing, encourages what they're doing, and he remembers, undoubtedly, what Paul had told him that Jesus had said was Paul's role. So Barnabas thinks, this is where Saul needs to be, Paul. So he either sends for or travels to Tarsus, gets Paul, brings him back to Antioch, and basically introduces him into the community at Antioch to be a teacher among them. And that then becomes really basically Paul's home base for the rest of his life, for the rest of his ministry. That's where he really develops his ministry to Gentiles, and then he eventually travels all over the Roman Empire taking the gospel to Gentiles. But it's in Antioch where he really gets his start and has any sort of successful ministry. Well, we owe Barnabas. We owe it to Barnabas that Paul ever even got there.
So see if this relates. It's kind of like Barnabas went up to Antioch and he saw Microsoft Windows for the very first time happening. And instead of saying, I am going to be an investor in this, I'm going to be one of the big guys here, I'm going to go find someone else to represent Microsoft Windows, and they get to be big here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Instead of seeing an opportunity for himself, he asked himself the question, what does God want? What does God will? And he knew, based on the revelation that Jesus had given to Paul, that he trusted, you know, he believed Paul, He wasn't an eyewitness to that. But being the judge of character that he was, he trusted that Paul was telling him the truth. And he discerned that this would be the opportunity for Paul to begin to play the role that God had asked him to play, that God had set him apart for.
And it was in a real grassroots way.
Exactly.
So again here, Barnabas is two things. One is really believing what he heard from Paul and really taking that seriously. It seems like looking for opportunity for Paul and not for himself.
Right.
Willing to not take the limelight, willing to see his role as supportive here of Paul and not as, boy, I get to be the one who gets to be the leader here of some great grassroots movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just astounded every time I think of Barnabas, because every time you see him demonstrating the same kind of obedience to God, a love of the will of God, generosity, humility. I mean, he just doesn't do anything wrong. It's just astonishing. At least what he does wrong is not recorded.
Yeah, I like that you added that, Jack. Because there ain't no such thing as a person
obvious,
that doesn't do anything wrong.
He's obviously a sinner like the rest of us. But
why doesn't it record that? Because for a lot of people, they hear about a person like Barnabas, and it's discouraging because they're not like him.
Well, of course, none of these people are we getting a snapshot of their life, really. We're getting the highlights, the historical highlights of their lives. I mean, that's true of even Paul. We do see Paul mess up. In fact, we see him mess up in a big way, but, you know, really only once. The rest of the time, it's not their intention of giving us some kind of insight into their character. We're watching God at work in their lives, in the big history-making stuff that they're doing. So the agenda, the purpose is really different. They're not intended to be a model of faith for us in the sense that a biography might, or a real detailed
but that's what we're doing here
character
today.
Portrait might.
We're looking at his character.
Well, we are, but even there, it's just the highlights of his character, some of the times where he was really doing it right. But that doesn't mean, I mean, we can't conclude from that. It would be a real mistake to conclude from that, that he was always doing it right, because that just simply can't be true.
How does a man become like this? And I'm including women. Mm-hmm. How does a woman become
sure.
like this?
Well, two things. Ultimately, of course, God creates them. All of us who are children of God are only children of God because God is creating us to be that. It's by his work within us that we are transformed and we are reshaped and we are remade and redefined by the living God himself through life circumstances. But how does God do that? Just through those momentous choices that we make in our life, where at various junctures we have, you know, we come upon a fork in the road of our life, and we can either go for ambition or we can go for the will of God, to submit to the will of God. And some of those moments are very obvious to us. I mean, we know what we're doing. We're making a determination that I'm going to define myself as this kind of person rather than this other kind of person. Other decisions, other forks in the road are not quite as obvious to us. They kind of sneak up on us, and we find ourselves going one way or the other without even really knowing we made the decision. But every one of those decisions is defining our own existence and shaping our character and shaping our heart.
And those forks in the road aren't just like graduations and weddings and those kinds of forks in the roads. That's not what you're talking about, though those big times exist. I think when I think about what you're saying, it's the forks in the roads that happen every day.
Daily, yeah.
That happen lots of times every day.
Right.
When I'm deciding, am I going to do what's right, or I'm going to give in to my own selfishness?
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to demand somebody be something so that I feel comfortable, or do I mourn the loss of not having what I'd rather they be?
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things that come up all the time. Will I tell the truth or will I lie? Am I willing to look radically at the reality of my own life, or do I just want to cover it over and make up a fantasy? All of those are forks that we come to on the road all the time. That one of them by themselves really is insignificant. And yet I think a whole lifetime can go by and always choose, even by default, the same wrong, weakening road.
Right.
I was talking to a woman recently who's just turned 70, and I was so struck by the work she's done in her life to choose forks that bring maturity and wisdom to her. As I was sitting before her, I was thinking about another woman that I know who's 70. And I said to this woman, you know what? You look like twice the woman. You look like two people here in relationship to this other woman that's 70 also that I know. Because of the different choices that you've made, the different direction that you keep on trying to go toward growth. And in fact, at that very moment, she was headed toward a deep and powerful and difficult understanding of loss in her life at 70. And it made her bigger.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. I think we make ourselves into more substantive people when we choose wisdom, when we choose God, when we choose to be what God wants us to be, intended us to be, created us to be. We make ourselves more substantive people, more interesting people, deeper, more profound people.
Stronger, more humble, more compassionate, more loving. But, you know, I'm uncomfortable with leaving it when I choose to do what God wants me to do, because I think that's really hard for... I think you're right, absolutely. But it's really hard to get a grip on what exactly that means. From situation to situation, it's very different. But there are very menial situations in life where we are choosing God, where I might feel critical of you, and I decide, instead of being critical, I just swallow it and don't say anything. And allow perhaps somebody to think better of you than of me.
Mm-hmm.
It could be at a time when I know I shouldn't spend money, but I would really like to spend some money on something that would make somebody think well of me, or I might feel better, but I know it's wrong, and decide not to spend that money or eat that cake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, things that seem silly, but added together, are choices about whether I'm following God or whether I'm following my own ambition, my own pride, my own way.
Right. That's right. Those silly little choices are rooted in a basic, fundamental, underlying heart attitude that is going to manifest itself in big things when the big things come along, just as much as the little things when the little things come along. So it's by ratifying that orientation of the heart at every juncture, at every moment, at every silly little thing that happens, to ratify and to affirm the decision to be somebody for others instead of myself, to be someone who's mastered by nothing except goodness and righteousness, who always does what's good and right, not what I want to do. We can't turn off things like selfishness and pleasure seeking and revenge. You know, we can't be vengeful in little things and then the big thing comes along and decide I'm not going to be vengeful. Or we can't be selfish in little things and the big thing comes along and I decide I'm going to turn off my selfishness there.
Yeah, because all along we're building character.
Exactly.
You know, this is so important to emphasize. And you and I are going to talk at a sexuality conference for singles, and I'm supposed to be talking on female sexuality. And I was thinking a lot about that. And it seems, and this will relate, I was thinking about, well, what is female sexuality? And I think it has a lot to do with a lot of things, but one of the things is humility, it's vulnerability, it's openness. To be a truly vulnerable sexual woman, those things are very much required. And yet, what I see in the single community is that what they're doing is not heading often toward a place that would bring them to openness, but a demanding, clenched fist spirit that says, I must have a relationship. I'm going to demand it on my own terms, whether I get it through being sexual in ways that are not appropriate for this time of my life or for the commitment that I have to this person, or I demand it through being manipulative, by showing myself to be something that I'm not, by being in a relationship perhaps that's abusive of me, and I maintain it even though I know that it's hurtful to me. How do I possibly then go into a relationship of marriage that requires openness, that requires humility, having built a demanding, clenched fist heart, it won't happen. They think very often, if I get married, that will solve my problem. No, it needs to be prepared beforehand.
That's good. And every other virtue is the same thing, is what you're suggesting. It's just like...
Absolutely. That's just an example of... Yes, across the board. I have to be preparing myself to be what I ultimately want to be by the small choices that happen along the way. Mm-hmm. And something big, like getting married, isn't going to solve me. Mm-hmm. It's going to follow along the course that I've already set for myself. I can't all of a sudden be a good mom and have been a person that has only been selfish and looking at my own needs. I have to be a person that is willing to give up a lot of what I want for myself and learn that throughout being a mom, or I'm not going to get the ultimate prize of having a child that is a lover of good. Not that that's guaranteed anyway.
Right. No, that's good.
But are you with me?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly right.
So this came from the question, how does a Barnabas become a Barnabas? And the two answers were, I choose what's right, I choose what's good, and God's the one that authors that in my life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You see the consistency of it, because the other remarkable event in Barnabas' life is when he stood up to Paul. You know, this person that he has supported and that he has nurtured and that he has done everything he can to support and encourage him in fulfilling the role that was destined for him, that very same Paul, Barnabas stood up against. They were about to begin on their second missionary journey. Well, back up a second. When they left on their first missionary journey, it was Paul and Barnabas traveling with a young man named John Mark. They traveled from Antioch, sailed over to Cyprus, traveled the length of the island of Cyprus, and some things happened. Then they sailed to what is now the southern coast of Turkey. And John Mark, for some reason that the text doesn't really make clear, left them at that point and went home. His home was in Jerusalem. So he left them. He wouldn't stick out the trip with them. So now they're about to leave on their second missionary journey, and Barnabas wants John Mark to go with them. And Paul basically says, no, he's a quitter. He won't have the perseverance. He won't have the endurance. I'm not going to take him with us. Now, I don't exactly know why. The text doesn't really make it clear. Would that be inconvenient for Paul? Is Paul being vindictive, you know, punishing him for leaving him the first time? That's not clear to me what exactly his motive was. But what's really interesting is Barnabas is now in a supportive role of John Mark. And basically what he's saying is, I see in John Mark a person of substance, a person of character. John Mark is not ultimately a quitter. John Mark is going to make it. John Mark is valuable, and I want to take him. Paul would hear nothing of it, and Barnabas ended up traveling a different journey with John Mark, and Paul took somebody else with him, took Silas with him instead. Well, by the end, we see that, I can't remember what letter it is, but Paul is writing a letter where he's sending some greetings or something to John Mark, or saying something very positive about John Mark. By the end of Paul's life, John Mark has clearly proved himself to Paul. Well, Barnabas saw that right away. You know, Barnabas saw that and had a big disagreement with Paul about that. Paul was wrong and Barnabas was right. Barnabas, this person who had trained himself to see the heart, to discern the character, to discern what made people tick, knew even then on that occasion that John Mark was on the right track. He was a good guy. He was going to make it. Paul couldn't see it. And you see Barnabas one more time playing the role of bringing out the best in somebody else, trying to create the opportunity for someone else to grow and to be nurtured and to thrive and to prosper and to become what God wanted them to become. He does the same thing in John Mark's life that earlier he had done in Paul's life.
I'm thinking again at risk, because there was certainly a risk when he tried to promote Paul. Paul was a murderer. Paul was somebody nobody trusted. And so he really put his own reputation on the line. Mm-hmm. And now here's Barnabas with, I would imagine, after on a missionary journey and all they'd gone through together, they were quite friends.
Mm-hmm.
And he stood up for John Mark at the risk of that friendship.
Yeah, and in fact, the text would seem to indicate that it was a sort of a bitter parting. So at least temporarily, there was alienation between Paul and Barnabas over this.
Yeah, we're really not seeing a wimp here.
No.
We're not seeing a guy that's afraid to stand up. We're seeing a guy who's really standing up and also willing to take a back seat.
Right. The scene that I've just described is the one place where I think we can see Paul's sin at work. You know, it's one thing to have an honest disagreement with Barnabas, but it sure looks like something else was also at work here to create that kind of alienation and that kind of
rift between the two.
Yeah, to create that rift between them. Somebody's selfishness, somebody's sin, somebody's evil was at work here. And it looks like Paul to me. It looks like we're seeing the sinfulness of Paul at work.
You know, Paul would have been quite a man to handle. You know,
yeah.
I'm thinking about this guy being a murderer. I'm kind of stuck on that. You know, that's that's really quite a lot of passion to want to kill people. And maybe he was passionate because he believed so much in his faith. But maybe he was passionate, and maybe undoubtedly he was passionate out of his own immaturity. Needing to hurt other people, needing to put people under him. There's something really, really diabolical underneath what he would have seen as his seen ambition for wiping out the Gentiles. This is a man who's got a lot going on underneath. And I guess maybe we're seeing that surface some here.
Yeah.
It didn't all get taken away. It makes me think of that passage where Paul says, you know, I have this thorn in my flesh and it just doesn't go away. And I guess this isn't another option. I'm just a man with selfishness. And I see that coming out in me. This self-preservation, this ugliness, this selfish ambition. And I guess that could also be what the thorn in his flesh is. Because you just don't get over that, Jack, very fast. I'm sure that Paul really mightily struggled with his own person, with his own passions that were misdirected. I think also of that time when he says that in Romans where he says, I know what I want to do, but I just don't do that. And he's really struggling with his humanness. He's really in a fight with him.
Mm-hmm.
He's tough to handle, even for himself. And so am I. I mean, I really relate to that in Paul. I'm really a handful sometimes for myself and for other people. And I know how hard it is to work against the drives in me that are very deep and to work toward trying to do what's right. I see myself as being Paul in a rift with Barnabas just out of my own, got to do it this way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a crucial thing to come to terms with, is that these men and women that we see in the Bible that are held up as people of God, as servants of God, as prophets of God, as apostles and so on, there's this human tendency to want to idealize them and turn them into people who are not normal human beings, that somehow their relationship with God has transformed them into people who are not sinful any longer. And it becomes unthinkable to us that somebody like an apostle could sin or that a prophet could sin. But the fact of the matter is, that's not the way it works. The fact of the matter is that God, all of us as human beings are sinners. That's a given. That we need to recognize that right up front and take that as foundational. And then does God use some of us to accomplish his purposes? Well, he uses all of us to accomplish some purposes, and some people he gives very remarkable life, history-changing kinds of roles. But not because they're extraordinarily good, not because they have somehow transcended their sinfulness. It's in spite of the fact that they're sinners that God does that. It's very important to see that, because everything in us wants to look at it the other way.
I know that this might be hard for you to believe, Jack, but somebody said to me the other day, you know what, Christine, you're a truly remarkable person. I think for what they see there, right, in the context that they understand, they're right, but they don't see the whole person.
Right.
They don't really see all of me. And I know that God made me remarkable in that way, or really talented in that way. That's it. I think God made that because, gee, I'm kind of a flunky, you know, like everybody else. You know, I'm just marching along here, trying to do my best and tripping over most obstacles. And yet God has built them some things in my life that are really good. And it's kind of amazing to me. It's humbling to me.
Right. And
but both are true. There's this good stuff that he built, and there's so much that's not so good stuff.
And that's what we see in these men and women that we confront in the Bible. Yes, they are very remarkable men and women. They do stand out of the sea of humanity for the wisdom that they have, for the humility that they have, for the generosity that they display, for their faith that they evidence. I mean, all those things really truly are remarkable, but we have to keep it in perspective. Yes, all those things are remarkable, but these are remarkable attributes of sinful people, of people who are fundamentally capable of all kinds of cruelty and thoughtlessness and insensitivity and selfishness and ambition and all kinds of mean, nasty stuff that infects all of us human beings, and they're just as capable as we are.
Yeah, and I think we really need to work at seeing that. Otherwise, we put people on a pedestal that they don't belong on, and we come to think, well, maybe I can't really ever be that way. So often in my counseling, Jack, have people say, gosh, I know you would never do this. And I feel kind of stunned every time, like, well, why do you think I understand what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Because I mean, you really experienced me understanding you. You know why I understand you? Because I've been there. Mm-hmm. I know it. I know what's in my heart.
And I am you.
I am you. I get it. I get it. I get it. And yet, gosh, almost always people will say, well, no, you don't look that way. You know, you can't be that way. And I do have a little bit of a yuppie kind of polished look. And I think that kind of doesn't fit with kind of looking sloppy like I am inside. So it's, you know what I'm saying? It's a little bit of a decoy also.
Yeah.
And but it's hurtful to people. It's hurtful.
Yeah, I think you've commented before the common phenomenon of people looking at their, sitting in their church, looking around at their church and thinking they're the only one who doesn't seem to be able to rise above and be victorious and obey God the way we're supposed to obey God, and they feel so alone. And that's tragic. I mean, if there's anything the Bible teaches us, it's that we are not alone in that. Everybody else out there is just like me. And if they are hiding that fact from me, then that's a very cruel lie that they're telling me, because the truth of the matter is we're all cut of the same cloth.
And yeah, I think the reason we see people that way as better than us is in part because we aren't sharing who we really are. And to share who we really are is a risk. I know that, for example, we've had some letters that were written here by people who say, you know, Christine, you're kind of a mess. Let me help you out because you're sharing these things that kind of show that you're not very spiritual. You're not very wise. You're not very mature. And well, on one hand, absolutely right, guys. But on the other hand, the reason that I can share those things is because I have grown. There is some maturity in me. There's a willingness to admit to the truth, even though there's a risk of that kind of, that shunning.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of shunning is tough to take. We are people who want to see ourselves as better than, and when we find somebody who's showing some of their underside, very often we go at it.
And the maturity that you're talking about ultimately comes from making the decision that in the final analysis, it really doesn't make any difference what other people think of me. It's what God thinks of me is the only thing that counts. And he already knows that I fail, and it's his mercy that I'm counting on. It's his grace that I'm counting on. Whether other people are merciful or gracious to me is of no consequence to me. I am what I am, and there is no risk in me revealing that, because they're not my judge. They don't count.
And I would say for me, there's not no risk. It's less and less of a risk.
Right.
Because more and more, it's okay what God thinks of me, and it's okay more and more what
right.
people think of me.
Right.
At the end of this century, the big questions about reality and being human rise with unexpected power. We ask, ever more agonizingly, what does it mean to be human? How do human beings fit into this vast cosmos? Where to from here? In his News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality, McKinsey Study Center member Wes Hurd shows how our present-day culture answers these questions in radically non-biblical ways. He shows how the prevalent postmodern view of life is fed to us through television, popular music, and education. However, he also states that although postmodernism has many negative aspects, it may present opportunities for biblical Christians to dialogue more openly with people who need real answers to some big questions. Call McKenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality.
This program ends the end of March, and we've been on the air for about 3 years. Jack, as you look back over the last 3 years, what are some of the things that you feel really great about having communicated?
Well, you're going to make me think. Well, I have appreciated being given the opportunity to just kind of share the evolution of my thought, the development of my thought, as I have devoted my life to studying the Bible and trying to understand the Bible and trying to come to terms with what is it saying to us and about our humanity and our existence before God. I know how much my life has been changed as I have grown to more deeply understand what the Scriptures are saying. And I've learned the difference between an authentic, genuine confrontation with the Bible and its message as opposed to a kind of culture of Christianity. I was raised in a culture of Christianity and I didn't even understand my own faith. I came over the course of my life of studying the Bible to have a deeply instilled conviction that the Bible really is telling the truth and I need to live my life believing that it's true and letting it guide my life. So that has been so fresh for me and that has been so vital for me and so important to me that it really is a privilege to get to share that with other people in hopes that they can begin to make that transition as well. Take the Christianity of their culture and transform it into a Christianity of their insides, of their heart.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKinsey staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKinsey staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKinsey Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKinsey, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKinsey Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program,
The telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.